Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. So glad to have you with us as we start another week in real time. If you're listening to us on the radio, if you're listening on a podcast, who knows what day this is? As you're listening, you probably know. But we're very glad to have you here. A couple of quick notes before we get going. Of course, you can watch us on Facebook Live, as you always can. Just go to the GPB news page on Facebook. And you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB, where we hope you'll follow us. And by the way, we like to see your comments on both of those platforms as we go through the show. We already got one tweet or Facebook Live post from Cindy Simpson, who wants us to congratulate Chipper Jones on making the Baseball Hall of Fame. So congratulations, Chipper Jones. Probably Jim Galloway, the least controversial thing happening in the news anywhere today.
You know,
he should be in the Hall of Fame.
We are about to enter the dog days of summer, and it just doesn't feel like we're going to have anybody just hiding under the porch, does it?
I don't think so. That's Jim Galloway. You know he's with me on Mondays and Fridays. He's the lead political writer for the AJC. He's in the paper on Wednesdays and Sundays. Had a really interesting column about all the women who are running in the Democratic Party in the state of Georgia. We're going to talk a bit about that a little bit later. And he also oversees the Political Insider blog at Politically Georgia, part of the myajc.com website. Galloway, nice to see you today.
It's great to be here.
We've also got Dr. Andra Gillespie. She, of course, a political science professor at Emory University, a frequent panelist on the show, I'm very happy to say. And finally finishing up this book that we've been hearing about, it feels like forever.
Yeah, I'll hit send either today or tomorrow.
Do we have a working title?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's called Race in the Obama Administration, Substance, Symbols, and Hope.
Congratulations.
Right. Thank you.
And it's just because we're talking about it, do you have a publication date? Or they hope to have it out at a certain point?
Oh, I mean, they hope to have it out like a long, long, long time ago. So, I mean, I think they'll set it based on what their production schedule is.
It'll be a Christmas gift probably, right?
It could be. Yeah, it could be. Great. I don't want to say for sure.
All right. Well, congratulations on getting down to the end of it. Heath Garrett, our Monday regular, is with us. He's a Republican consultant and has been working in party politics in Georgia for a very long time. Always, we point out, closely associated because of his professional relationship with U.S. Senator Johnny Isaacson. Well, Johnny, he's coming home fairly soon. The House is out, but the Senate's staying up there for a little bit while to do some confirmations. Is that right?
Do some confirmations and to stay in pro forma session and get a few things done and, you know, be at work in August.
When do they want to? Oh, they're going to be back here?
Well, I think there's a question. They may end up with a week or so, but not your usual four-week summer break.
Wow. This is David Perdue's idea.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. This was our Senator David Perdue who says they're not working enough in Washington. I bet there are a lot of members of the Senate who really don't like him right now for that. Also joining us today, Representative Scott Hocum. He is a Democrat from Atlanta. Tell us the shape of your district in Atlanta, Scott.
The shape of the district is like an upside-down lobster that's been run over by an 18-wheeler. It's if you like that description.
Yeah.
It's roughly centered around Spaghetti Junction. I represent unincorporated DeKalb, Chamblee, Brookhaven, Dorval, and a little bit of Gwinnett.
Okay. Thank you for being here, Scott. We're glad to see you. Let me start with just a kind of a brief look at a story that is new, breaking news today. Tennessee Senator Bob Corker, the Republican who is not going to run for re-election up there and who has been at times fairly outspoken in his criticism of President Trump, spoke to the Atlanta, that they call it the Downtown Rotary, which is really, Jim, the Rotary, most of the big corporate leaders in town, some of the nonprofit leaders. People like you and I get to go over there only on a rare occasion.
If you want to talk to the business community in Georgia, that's where you go.
So Corker was there today. He had a lot of comments. The one that stood out for me, we had a GPB staffer over there to watch to see what he might say. Jim, he apparently told the Rotary that he hopes there would be, or wishes there would be, I'm not sure which word is more correct, a third-party candidate for president. In a way, that's not surprising because he obviously is not on the Trump train, but he's also not going to become a Democrat. So maybe that's not as surprising, but it seems like a big headline to me in some ways.
The question is, okay, where does the money come from? Who puts it up? And basically, it would be something of a suicide run.
Yeah.
Intended to sabotage a Trump second term. So that's those are objectives that would really really narrow the field that group.
Andra, when you heard us say this, you had a particularly strong, I think, reaction is a fair way to characterize it.
Well, it wasn't so much about the third party election party, even though I agree with Jim on this. You know, third party candidates in presidential elections have at best served as spoilers in elections. So, I mean, you kind of have to understand that going into the race if that's what you want to do. But my reaction was to Senator Corker's desire for a parliamentary system because he wants multi-party sort of elections. And we're way past that sort of in terms of our development. So, I mean, we would have to pretty much start from scratch in order to create that type of system again because we have single-member districts and first-past-the-post elections. Those naturally tend to yield themselves towards the development of two major parties. And so structurally, it's a really difficult thing to do. And I would add, if we tried to do it with a presidential system, my comparativist colleagues could correct me if I'm wrong, but that's actually a little unstable. So we're kind of stuck with what we have.
So just to explain that part of it, he said third party for president. He also said he wishes there were a parliamentary system. I think he was talking in a kind of a broader philosophical way, suggesting that he doesn't like the binary system we have in Congress right now. You would either vote for or against. Scott, he suggests that if you had a parliamentary system, he believes it's possible people could form coalitions around issues instead of parties. Andra points out it's not practical or realistic. But philosophically, we understand sort of where he's coming from, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that ability exists now. It's just not exercised.
Right.
And what is often forgotten by members of Congress is that they are a separate constitutional branch. Instead, the majority party all too often acts subservient to the executive branch, but they have a lot of power and a lot of ability to make a difference. And what is interesting about his comments, while perhaps somewhat unique in terms of the timeliness, although I would certainly support a spoiler in 2020, is that when we have issues with moving things forward, people usually jump at structural changes. Instead of really trying to address whatever the issue is, you come up with these new novel ideas about how to change the structure without dealing with the actual issues that we're facing.
And I think it's really interesting, right? His notion of he wishes there's going to be an independent run. I think that's a foregone conclusion that somebody's going to run as an independent for president. There are a number of multi-billionaires. They just happen to be center left. So if there is going to be a spoiler effect, right, the question is, are they going to be more of a spoiler for the Democratic nominee, the ones that are names are prominently mentioned right now, or is he pining for somebody that would be a spoiler for Donald Trump's coalition, right? And I think that's an interesting point. We're going to have one, I believe.
Jeff Flake is the name that I keep that comes to the top of my list.
Right. But right now, the independents we're talking about, you've got Mark Cuban talking about running. He would definitely be a center left candidate. You've got the CEO, former CEO and chairman of Starbucks talking about running. These
Howard
people,
Howard Schultz,
they could self-fund. Those are center left independent races, which would be fascinating. The question is, does a Jeff Flake or somebody like that who's already retiring from the Senate, has nothing else to lose, become a disruptor for the disruptor in chief?
Okay. The other couple of things that he said, according to our GPB reporter on the scene, is that he says he never could have imagined serving more than two terms, so his deciding to retire at this point shouldn't be unusual. He says he believes our children are going to suffer because of the Republican budget that was passed this year, the $1 trillion spending budget that the Republicans are going to have to deal with, and that Trump is trying to push back on a little bit. He also said, my party is the party of traditionalists. We know that our institutions are what keep us from not being Venezuela, but we don't want to go down that slippery slope by tearing down our institutions. Heath, that's another very clear shot at where Trump is taking the party.
Yeah, Bob Corker, Jeff Flake, even a lot of the senators who are up for re-election again in the next few years are starting to show their independence from the president on key issues where he gets at Republican traditional principles and values. And I think that there's a question about how much, you know, whether there's a huge coalition about that. But the president is being successful on a lot of policy issues that are core Republican, and that's allowing him to maintain the base.
All right, let's get into on Friday on this show. Those of you who were with us will know we kind of took a break from the day in and day out campaign news of this cycle to have Alan Abramowitz.
He'll appreciate that one.
Alan Abramowitz was on the show, political science professor, one of Andra's colleagues over at Emory, and talking about voting trends over, you know, long periods of time. And it was a fascinating conversation, which did set us up for this upcoming election. But my point is, we've sort of taken a break from the day in and day out, especially of the gubernatorial race, and there's a lot to catch up on. You all set to do that, everybody?
Yeah, let's go.
Let's start with this, if we can. Stacey Abrams has released, or the, I think it's a, it may be a Democratic, Georgia Democratic Party funded ad, Jim.
Mm-hmm. It is.
A biographical spot that starts to tell voters who she is. Let's listen to the audio of that TV commercial.
Growing up, my parents encouraged us to dream big, but we went without health insurance, struggled to get a good public education, and faced debt despite my parents working full-time jobs. My story's not unique. I'm running for governor because I know we can celebrate the progress we've made and go so much further, create thousands of new jobs, expand Medicaid, keep hospital doors open. As governor, I'll fight for every family to have the freedom and opportunity to thrive. That's not dreaming. We can do this.
All right. Panel, what do we think of that spot as an introduction to the general election campaign? Who wants to take a shot at it?
That was a perfectly standard defining biographical ad. And off air, you had mentioned the notation of with of that they put Sarah Riggs Amico's name on there. Well, the candidate for lieutenant governor. That's just a standard subterfuge to allow them to spend on behalf of one candidate. Republicans do the same thing.
Okay. Scott, I think what's interesting about that commercial is, I think Jim is clearly right. We see that kind of biographical spot early in a race. But it sort of goes along with the way Abrams has opened the general election phase of this campaign. She, for the last week, since the runoff was decided on the Republican side, has refrained from attacking Brian Kemp. She's out there talking about a jobs package, some $10 million or more. At least for the time being, she's decided to focus on issues and not go after her opponent. Yeah?
I think that's going to hold true for a while. And what Stacey's campaign is about is primarily three things. And they're all investing in Georgians. It's about education. And you heard the role that it played in her own life story, which is really incredible. Rose through poverty to graduate from Yale Law School. She talks about health insurance, which of course is a massive issue here in Georgia, and talks about the expansion of Medicaid, which I think we need to do, and many others. And she talked about debt and that struggle. She, I think, is taking out some of the likely attacks that she's going to be facing. But the fact is, so many Georgians are in that space, and they're living paycheck to paycheck with stagnant wages. And so she is speaking to issues that I think people want to hear about, and she's also speaking to issues that she can actually impact as the next governor.
I mean, I agree. I think she's, you know, staking out her positions. She's doing the introduction, and I think at this point, given the fact that it's July, like, you hold your powder, like, there's no need to go negative this early in the campaign. You still have to kind of, you know, at this point, reintroduce yourself to the electorate, and especially to people who may not have been paying attention up until this point. And I think she is actually trying to stem the attack about her debt by sort of framing it as she's every woman. And so she's establishing empathy with voters.
Yeah, a couple points. Number one, I forgot to mention, Bill. This is the Democratic Party of Georgia was given $1 million by George Soros in late June.
Yeah, this so is, they got some so, money
so
to burn.
Can, so you can say this is part of it. The other thing you have to look at is another ad that it may have been internet only that the Democratic Party put out just as the Republican race finished. It was and it used extensive amount of video from Casey Cagle saying this is a race of you know who's got the biggest who has the biggest shotgun, the biggest truck, and who can be the craziest, all right? So you have Stacey Abrams very definitely trying to run as the opposite of crazy right now.
But I also wonder, Heath, and you can comment anything you want, but let me throw you a question on that. I get it. Early in the race, you want to do positive biographical spots. As Andra says, you want to hold your fire for when you really need it later. I get all that. But I also wonder if there's something else at play here, and the fact that she's at least started by running a positive issue-oriented campaign. Is it Stacey Abrams, if she can win this election, it's going to be by reaching across that chasm between, you know, people who were at one point willing to, they were more likely to vote Republican. They've done that for the last couple of decades in this state. And I have to wonder if there's a part of this that's engineered toward making that kind of outreach, that by attacking Republicans in an angry, hostile way, she loses the potential perhaps to go after those people who right now might be on the fence. Is that a far-fetched idea?
No, I think that's definitely part of what she's doing, right? We've got to remember that even though insiders have been talking about this and know who Stacey Abrams is, she's actually introducing herself to the overwhelming majority of general election voters for the first time this week.
Yeah.
The vast majority of even our listeners probably haven't paid as much attention to this as maybe we have. And so you have a tough choice. What's your first introduction, particularly as a Democrat, right? You start out at a 5 to 7 point disadvantage against the Republican in statewide elections. So you have to make that up with the middle, so to speak. We can argue whether or not that middle, those 5 to 10% of particularly suburban women are the swing vote in this state, and how you introduce yourself to those voters is the only way she has a chance in November. Now, we can argue whether she really does or not, but at the end of the day, I think it's a pretty smart move on her part, even as a Republican, to introduce herself in a positive light, begin to try to inoculate from the attack she knows coming. But she is going to have to go on the attack in order to defeat a Republican in November.
Absolutely. But I will tell you what, she is going to, maybe not the Kemp campaign, but certainly a supporter of the Kemp campaign, some PAC is going to do their very best to define Stacey Abrams as the stranger in our midst. You know, you already see it coming. The socialists, they will say everything except for her race.
Well, why don't we go ahead and give our listeners a chance to hear mm-hmm. what the Republican Governors Association is doing in just that respect. Here's a spot that was on TV that the RGA, Republican Governors Association, released as the runoff election was unfolding.
Meet Stacey Abrams, most radical liberal to ever run for governor, a career politician funded by Nancy Pelosi's California friends.
I'm thrilled that Stacey Abrams won the Democratic gubernatorial primary in Georgia last night. I look forward to supporting her campaign in the months to come.
Abrams wants you to pay more in taxes to fund her liberal big government ideas. Stacey Abrams, funded by Pelosi's friends, loved by Hillary, too liberal for Georgia.
Andra?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not surprised by that at all. So, you know, part of this is Abrams trying to define herself in her own campaign, which is what you're supposed to do. And you have the RGA that's seeking to define her in its stead. And it's going back to common standard tropes. So you got to link her to sort of like the far left of the party. And yeah, she's more progressive than, you know, previous Democratic gubernatorial candidates have been. But radical is a step too far. But, you know, they're just sort of spinning that. And then you got to tie her to sort of the traditional straw people that, you know, that scare Republicans off. So here's Nancy Pelosi and Hillary Clinton. You know, 30 years ago it would have been Ted Kennedy. I mean, you know, it's always sort of like this trope. And so, you know, it has traction. And so it's just a question of how much traction it's going to get.
Scott, what do you think about the Abrams jobs creation proposal? It's not a lot of money. It's a starting point. It gives her a chance to talk about it. Is that an issue that she's going to be able to really make something out of?
I think so. And one thing about Stacey is, and I think everybody would say this from across the political space, is she's an extremely hard worker. She's a careful thinker. And In terms of policy, she usually gets it pretty right. And she certainly did when she was a member of the General Assembly. And I think the focus on jobs is exactly where it needs to be, because this has been playing out for a number of election cycles now where so many people feel that the economy is not working for them anymore. And so she can tap into policies that resonate with people in terms of getting the economy to work for them. And particularly, this, I think there's two issues. One are opportunities, particularly in rural areas, which is a place where Democrats have not done all that well. And then secondly is to address this issue of wage stagnation, because people are just stuck.
All right, let's do this. We've got to get a break in. And when we come back, I want to talk about the nationalization of this race. We've seen some really clear evidence of that over just the past few days alone. But as we do, Tom Faust called my attention a breaking news story. Galloway, this will be of special interest to you. Your folks broke it on Politically Georgia. Governor Deal suspends Georgia jet fuel sales tax, helping Delta and others. The lead is Governor Nathan Deal announced Monday he was suspending collection of the state sales tax on jet fuel, keeping a promise to Delta Airlines and other companies that the General Assembly rejected during the politically charged 2018 legislative session. You know what? Before we take the break, let's just remind listeners how that unfolded.
Yeah, that is something of a statement right there. Of course, what we did was we had Casey Cagle sabotage a tax break on jet fuel that affected Delta the most, but also would have also saved other airlines some money. And because Delta aligned itself with anti-gun violence positions after the Parkland massacre, Casey said that was anti-NRA and thus anti-Second Amendment, and he was done with them.
It was got a like 50-some million-dollar tax break for Delta had it gone through at the time, correct?
Yes. Yeah, it was significant money.
And, of course, Casey Cagle was endorsed by Nathan Deal, but now with that chip off the table,
he can go ahead and suspend the tax. And, of course, this was one of the issues, Heath, that caused the business community to wonder whether Casey Cagle was really the partner they'd always thought he was, operating in their interests at the Capitol. And it caused some businesses to back away from his campaign.
There's no question. It seems like this was eons ago, and it was really just a few months ago that this happened. But it was absolutely the defining moment for Casey Cagle's rise in the primary, because it showed the Republican base, right, that he was a conservative fighter. At the same time, it simultaneously caused many of his investors a lot of heartburn and pause and, you know, probably some, you know, temporary delay in some funding there. But obviously that's not what happened to him at the end of the day. But this is big news. It also shows you why checks and balances matter and that governors do matter, and they have a lot of influence over economic development.
This is a strong governor state.
It really is.
Let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way. When we come back, let's talk about and show you some examples of the nationalization of the Georgia governor's race. You're listening to Political Rewind.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Ooh, drive away. Ooh, drive so far.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Heath Garrett, Republican strategist, is with us. Representative Scott Holcomb, Democrat. I say from Atlanta, but you've got Atlanta's kind of the center of the district. You've got bits and pieces of DeKalb County in there as well, right?
It's an everyman district.
An everyman district. Dr. Andre Gillespie, political science professor from Emory University. And, of course, Jim Galloway. Before we talk about the nationalization, we ended the segment by saying that Casey Cagle turned off some of the business community that had been supporting him when he fought the Delta tax break during the legislative session. And you say that's exactly where Stacey Abrams is looking to pick up support.
Yeah, yeah. The one thing we didn't bring out in the conversation is if you look at what Stacey Abrams was doing on the coast, was just talking jobs. Then you move over to the state capitol where Sarah Riggs Amico was also making a pitch to the business community about the need to avoid religious liberty fights. You see the space that Democrats, this opening that Democrats are trying to put a wedge into. and grab some of that business community support that might be up for the taking.
And I think that actually belies the sort of radical liberal agenda. So this is where and Stacey Abrams is really kind of threading a needle here. So, you know, she's definitely socially liberal. She's taking positions on things like, you know, healthcare that, you know, are decidedly progressive. But then there are these other things that are pro-business that a decade ago she might have sort of, you know, embraced as being neoliberal that, you know, politicians don't do anymore in the Democratic Party, but that's still there. And so it's, you know, really sort of hard to try to portray a Yale-educated tax lawyer as, like, not understanding business. And I think she's going to try to fall back on that to try to say, they can caricature me as this, but, like, seriously, really?
So since we knew that this race was going to be nationalized to a certain extent, because Stacey Abrams, of course, is working to make history to become the first African-American female governor of a U.S. State. But it really took on an entirely new complexion when the president of the United States, out of nowhere, endorsed Brian Kemp with only days to go until the runoff election, at which point this became ground zero in many ways for the races that we're going to see unfold in the midterm elections. So there's been a lot of writing about that over the weekend, late last week. I'm going to read to you just briefly a few of the things that are being said by the national media, and then I want to hear how the panel feels about the way this race is being characterized. Kevin Sack writes in the New York Times, and if anybody knows how to write about Georgia, it's Kevin. He lives here in Atlanta. He has for years. He worked at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, so he gets the contours, the landscape of the state. He says, almost overnight, Georgia's captivating governor's race between Brian Kemp and Stacey Abrams has taken on the dimensions of a defining moment, one that will, regardless of outcome, determine what the state represents and how it is perceived. That voters chose these two candidates reflects how Americans are embracing politicians on the basis of culture and identity, and how Georgia's politics are catching up with its rapid demographic changes. And he points out, of course, we have an ever-growing non-white population here. But then he says, but Georgia's political middle, long the dominant force behind the state's thriving commerce and pragmatic leadership, suddenly finds itself abandoned. And he goes on from there. In Time magazine, Stacey Abrams on the cover of a regional edition of Time, Molly Ball wrote, despite its red state reputation, Georgia's more diverse than Virginia and bluer than Alabama, two southern states that recently elected Democrats who ran on expanding health care. The economic focus of Virginia Governor Ralph Northam and Alabama Senator Doug Jones contrasted with cultural warriors who were opponents whose message echoed President Trump's. Let's stop there for a second. Andra, you follow this stuff better than anybody. Is Molly Ball making a reasonable point that we're in a better position to turn blue than even Virginia was in Alabama, or is that missing a few things?
So I think she's right about Alabama. I'm from Virginia, and there are more black people here in Georgia than there are in Virginia. So that's kind of like where the diversity comes from. You know, if you look at sort of the level of Asian American or Latino diversity, it's actually probably more diverse on those dimensions in Virginia than it is here. I have to check the census numbers to be sure about that. The difference between Virginia and Georgia is, and both of these states don't register by party, but you probably have pound for pound more white Democrats in Virginia than you do in Georgia.
No question.
So, like, yeah. So, I mean, yeah. So I don't completely agree with her on that. You also don't, while you have sort of the Atlanta suburbs and the diverse industries here that are bringing all different kinds of people here, we have to ask whether or not that compares to the DC suburbs. And so, you know, my running joke in Virginia is, especially if I'm driving south through Virginia, that I'm not really in Virginia till I get to Stafford County. And then there's the random joke about me being from real Virginia and not from, like, the D.C. suburbs. And no offense to my friends from D.C., because I love Northern Virginia, too. But, like, yeah, it's a very different type of cultural mix. So I don't know if I agree with
that.
I
also wonder, Scott, Ralph Northam began, I think I'm right, and Andra will certainly jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, Northam began running as a more conservative Democrat than Stacey Abrams did. That makes a big difference here, too, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it goes back to something that he said earlier in terms of the fight being over the middle. I'm not sure that that's right. I think Stacey's strategy is really to energize people who aren't currently engaged in the system and also to really energize people who tend to vote Democratic. And one way that you can compensate for a negative balance in terms of voters is by having your people turn out more. And so even if the state is more conservative, which I think it still is, but it's getting closer, you can overcome that negative balance by having your people really energized. Yeah. And that's what she's working toward.
You know,
I agree.
And let me ask you to pick up on something. Again, Molly Ball writing this very glowing profile of Stacey Abrams in Time magazine. It's really a lovely piece of if you like Stacey Abrams. But she says whether she can win is another matter. She points out that certainly Georgia has grown more purple. There could be a national wave that'll, you know, move towards Democrats, female candidates, perhaps African-American minority candidates. But then she quotes Whit Ayers, our good friend, the Republican pollster who spent right. many years here. And here's what she quotes him as saying. There's no question the state is becoming more diverse, but that doesn't mean a conservative state has all of a sudden become liberal, says Whit Ayers. All of Abrams' charisma, money, and momentum won't matter if the political math doesn't add up.
No, I think it's exactly right. There's a lot of discussion and a lot of hope, particularly on my Democratic friend's side, that the state is turning blue. When we do the demographic analysis, what we find, if you take Trump out of the equation, meaning that he's not on the ballot against somebody, he's in the equation, then this state is really what I call turning orange, right? We're a red state, which represents Republicans, and yellow is the color of libertarians. And so we actually have more growth in that kind of independent center than we do as far as raw Democrats. And so
you're not talking about somebody's hair here.
I'm not talking about somebody's hair here. I'm not doing that. But I'm trying to make the illustrative point, right, that the question becomes, right, I do think Stacey Abrams has an interesting strategy and a smart one, try to maximize the base and energize her voters to overperform what Democrats have been doing, which is the extreme low 40s, right, in a lot of these races. I think that gets you to a certain point. But what's actually the fastest growing demographic in the state is non-affiliated, not Republican, not Democrat. And our analysis is they're still center-right folks. And so the question is, can Brian Kemp get back to those folks in a smarter, better way than Stacey Abrams can? She's made a good first salvo with this ad, but I think it's just going to be harder given she positions herself so far to the left in the primary. And she is so progressive, right, that I don't know that center holds for her.
Yeah, Bill, here's the thing. The one criticism I've heard of the New York Times piece that you read about was that it was, and you said it, Stacey thought it was a little bit overwrought. And here's the thing. Is it a defining moment? Well, all moments are defining to some degree or another. But Stacey Abrams can't run a campaign that says, choose me or the end of the world is coming. Because that's not the way this is working. I mean, we are on a slow demographic shift, so this will be one of many moments to come. The person who is thus far characterizing it as an existential threat is Brian Kemp. He's the one who's saying this is for the soul of Georgia. So I think the drama is over on the right side rather than on the left, at least in this moment. The other thing I would say is what I think we see Stacey Abrams doing is kind of flipping the script here. The complaint among African Americans has been that the Democrats have assumed that we are going to be with them. So that they have left white Democratic candidates routinely leave them to the last two or three weeks of the campaign. I think what we're going to see is that Stacey has been doing the opposite. She has been paying a whole lot of attention to the base. And I think what we're going to see starting in September is I think you will see Stacey Abrams moving more toward that middle to see if she can pick off any of these women, particularly in the suburbs, who Donald Trump has really ticked off.
Andra, Jim referred to it in an interview that she gave to our reporter down in Middle Georgia, Grant Blankenship. Abrams did say that she thinks these articles that talk about that these are the extremes fighting this out are overwrought. Is that right? I mean, have the two of them staked out positions that leave them on the outer edges of the mainstream? Or is that just something we journalists love to be able to try to blow up?
So, I mean, they're archetypes, and especially for national media outlets, they've got to justify the ink space for, like, talking about this stuff. Like, you know, why, other than the New York Times being a paper of record in the U.S., why is the New York Times talking about a Georgia gubernatorial race? So they are creating these frames, and they're going to be oversimplified, and candidates are going to be upset with them, and that's just the nature of the business. When Abrams complains about these things, then she's also staking a position. She's trying to remind people that, yes, I need all of this national attention. It helps me raise money. It helps burnish my profile, but I'm one of you, and I haven't forgotten that I'm one of you. And so, you know, part of this is also a posture by speaking out against that as well. And so you kind of have to sort of acknowledge what's going on there. But, you know, in primaries, candidates tend to run more toward the extreme. I would argue in this particular cycle, we saw the Republicans run more clearly to the extreme. But, you know, on both sides, you tend to be a little more polarized in your primary election just because you're dealing with half of an electorate. And then you got to come back to the center for the general election. And so I think the question is, who can more credibly pivot toward the center based on how they performed in the primary?
Thank you for that. Scott, should we welcome the way the national media has decided to focus on Georgia? In the long run, is that good for us as a state? Is it good for your candidate, Stacey Abrams? Is it good for Brian Kemp? Or are they a distraction? Do they tend to inflame things that don't need to be? How do you see all that?
I mean, I pay attention to it, but I think that there is often a bit of a caricature aspect to it. The other thing that I don't really like is the devolving into sort of a race battle. I think by any objective measure, Stacey Abrams is incredibly qualified, talented, you name it. And against Brian Kemp, I think that her record stacks up incredibly well. So I hope that as the race goes forward, yes, it is historical what she is doing, but I hope that we have a real focus on the issues and what each person wants to do for the state. And what I'll add real quickly on Kemp, because what's been talked about a few times is a suburban district. From my own interactions with Republican voters, I have a lot of Republican friends, even Republicans in my immediate family, they were extremely turned off by the type of campaign that he ran. And he's going to have some real work to do in terms of getting back some of those typically conservative voters in November. I think that is a real issue for him that he's going to have to learn to fix.
And yet, Heath, you've got to say going in, just based on electoral history, still on the voter data that we see, I mean, you've got to say that Kemp goes into this thing as the favorite, doesn't he?
Well, there's no question that based on the voter population in the state of Georgia now and their identity with Republicans versus Democrats, he's got the advantage going in. Unlike the last three or four cycles, he cannot take it fully for granted. We are going to have the first test of real national money coming in for Stacey Abrams. What does the national media attention do? It guarantees money for Stacey Abrams. Mm-hmm. No question about it. I agree with Scott. I don't like the caricature because they're going to try to paint the South as still backwards and living in the 1960s, which we're all not.
Well, no. I got to admit, I didn't see that in any of the articles that I've read
but they're setting it up. They're setting it up. I can see it happen. As former Democratic Governor Roy Barnes says, the New York Times doesn't like to make the state of Georgia look good in their headlines over time. So I think it's going to be a real test in the modern era of that. But there's no question that Brian Kemp can't take anything for granted. He definitely had to run to the right in the primary farther than Casey Cagle had to or did in the race, and has more work to do coming back to the middle than a Johnny Isaacson or a Nathan Deal has had to do in the last couple of election cycles.
I need to get to another break. Before I do, Galloway, couple of interesting notes that I found reading Political Insider. Number one, you all made it clear to us what we probably could have suspected, but now have data to prove it. Brian Kemp's victory and Casey Cagle's collapse was of historic proportions in the state of Georgia. Never has this kind of whomping taken
this was a University of Minnesota, yeah. Some number crunching from way up north there, and between a primary and a runoff, no candidate for governor has ever gained more than Brian Kemp did. I think it was 41 something, and it said and they said that Casey Cagle had registered the second largest loss, except there was the reference to 1998, and they were saying Lewis Massey had won. But Lewis Massey, he resigned. He withdrew as a candidate right after that vote.
That was wonderful. A wonderful little piece of Georgia history. Lewis Massey ran for governor in the Democratic primary against Roy Barnes, who eventually won.
Yeah, Roy Barnes got 49%.
And Lewis, but it did force a runoff. And in an unprecedented move, Scott, Lewis Massey was convinced before the runoff would unfold to resign from the race to give the nomination to Roy Barnes. It's a little moment of interesting history. I guess it was Gordon Giffen.
It was Keith Mason.
Thank you. That's exactly who it was. One of the real insiders in Democratic politics here who convinced him to do that. But that was unheard of.
Yes, very selfless. And in terms of the collapse, it was monumental, but at the same token, most of the race going all the way through the primary was for second place, because there was a real sense that if Casey did not prevail and get 50% plus one, that he was going to be vulnerable in the runoff, and that all of that other support would coalesce. And we saw that. And certainly the tweet from the president helped, but I'm not convinced that it wouldn't have come out the same way, maybe with a little different turnout, but I'm not surprised that Casey did not ultimately win.
Well, as we go to a break, I would say if I'm Brian Kemp, I'd love taking that kind of momentum into the general election.
There's no question it shifted momentum greatly in his favor for uniting the party. I will say this, it's historic in its proportion because it's historic in its happening, right? Both in the modern era, having a president endorse in a statewide race with only 6 days to go. Previous presidents either picked the candidate and endorsed really early or stayed out of these races. Number two, Twitter has changed the landscape of politics. If you're a Donald Trump, you can move votes. Obama could have done this in some tight primaries when he was president. He was that popular in the Democratic primary. He just didn't do it with 6 days to go.
All right, go ahead real quick.
So here's my hypothesis about some of this stuff. I think Trump's leading from behind on this, and we're giving him a lot of credit for stuff we shouldn't be giving him credit for. I think he saw the wind, and I think he saw that, like, you know, Cagle was imploding because of that tape, and just, like, you know, decided he would go with whoever.
But that doesn't mean that his endorsement didn't have a significant impact.
Oh, I'm not saying it didn't help, but yeah. Kemp probably could have won that one on his own.
I will say the tracking polls showed a tremendous lead for Kemp.
Yeah, Cagle's own internal poll showed a spike the day that Trump endorsed Kemp. All right, got to get to a break. Jim, you had a fascinating story I mentioned at the beginning of the show about all the women running as Democrats in the state elections coming up. Let's talk about what that means and whether it signals a significant shift in our politics, certainly on the Democratic side. We'll get to that after this break.
On the next Fresh Air, kidnapped by Somali pirates. Michael Scott Moore talks with Dave Davies about his 2.5 years of captivity. He was beaten, considered suicide, attempted escape, and was eventually released after his mother raised $1.6 million in ransom. He has a new memoir, The Desert and the Sea. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Jim Galloway, certainly with no planning in advance, no plotting, no effort to coordinate, the Democrats in Georgia find themselves with a remarkable field of women who won their primaries, won runoffs, and are now on the ballot, either statewide or in a couple of congressional districts. That's really something.
Right. No, well, first of all, I would disagree a little bit. I think there was a little bit of coordination in this because we've seen. Not overt, but there were people seeking the same opportunity. But what you had on last Tuesday is Democrats did finish building out their ballot, and on the statewide and federal offices. You have a total of 11 women running, 9 of them are Democrat. The Democratic ticket now of on the top is 9 women and 9 men, which has never happened before in Georgia. It's got some tremendous implications, I think.
And okay, so first of all, what does it tell us, Andra, about the changing interest, for want of a better word, that voters have in seeing women get an opportunity to hold office in this state?
It's not just that people have an interest in seeing women run for office. It's that more women are running for office. And
right.
So the problem that we have in this country is that women are not encouraged at the same rate that men are encouraged to run for office. And what we've seen happen in the last few years, and some, the groundwork has been laid for decades, actually, with organizations that have particularly tried to offset the lack of socialization that women have gotten by telling women you can go run for office.
Melita Easters would certainly be one of the people who worked hardest at that.
Yeah. So we've seen that coupled with the current political environment and the rise of things like the Women's March and the Me Too movement, where women are encouraging each other to run for office, we've seen more women put their hat in the race. And because more women have put their hat in the race, they've opened up the possibilities for them to be able to win office. So the adage is that when women run, they win. And so once you start to control for all other factors, it's not that women don't run differently, it's not that they don't face sexism, but their chances are roughly equal to men in running for office. So we expect that there's going to be a net gain in female representation at all levels of government because there are just more women candidates this year.
And what do we think the impact of having all these women on the Democratic ticket, essentially the ticket? You're talking in the 6th District Congressional District, the 7th Congressional District, two other congressional districts.
You have a woman in the 1st District and the 10th.
Yeah, and it's the 6th and 7th we tend to focus on the most because that's Karen Handel in the 6th and Rob Woodall in the 7th, right, Scott? And there's some feeling they might be vulnerable, but then you've got governor, lieutenant governor, you've got
insurance commissioner,
you got two public service commissioners. So how is this going to shape what people do when they go to the polls, especially if the fulcrum may swing around suburban women?
Well, we'll see, right? I think that it's terrific that the Democratic Party has a gender balance ticket at the top, and the state is more than 50% female. I think women have been underrepresented in political life for a long time. And the other thing that I'll add is that all of these women are incredibly, incredibly talented. We've talked at length about Stacey Abrams, but the lieutenant governor candidate, Sarah Riggs Amico, she's a Harvard MBA grad. She is a very successful business person. She got into the race because she cares deeply about education and healthcare, and they've been important issues in her both professional life and personal. In terms of the 6th and 7th Congressional District, Lucy McGrath has a very compelling story, Delta flight attendant, and then lost her son tragically to gun violence. I think she'll be very competitive in the 6th. And then Carolyn Bordeaux in the 7th, I've known her for a while. She's one of the smartest people out there. She was a full professor at Georgia State, undergrad at Yale, can explain the budget and numbers better than I think anybody in Georgia. And she gets at a very deep level some of the challenges that we have and will bring some really thoughtful ideas forward. So I think it's going to be a really great campaign season.
Are you worried about this?
Not so much in the general election, particularly statewide races. I mean, this is an interesting phenomenon, right? We know that women make up a greater percentage of Democratic primary voters than they do as a percentage because of the focus on that by the Democratic primaries. And it does lead to a societal good, right? More women running for office is a generally good thing all the way around. I think the question becomes, in the general election, right, are people voting in a statistically significant way simply because of somebody's gender, which I think belies the whole classical feminist argument, right? You shouldn't vote for somebody just because they're male, right? And so I think these discerning suburban voters, particularly women, I was raised by a single professional mother, right? And I'm married to a very successful executive female, right? And they are offended by the idea that they're going to vote solely based on the gender of who they're choosing. They're going to base on the content of the philosophy of the candidate. I think most women are that way. And I think that that's what belies this whole argument that just because they're running, they're going to win.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree with you on that. So party does matter more than gender. And so you don't see women defecting and voting for women of other parties just because they're female. However, the problem is that both parties have not done enough to encourage women to run for office. And so now that you have women running for office, it turns out that it's Democrats in this case who've done a better job of recruiting women to run for office. Some of these women aren't going to win because they're running in districts that, you know, just don't have enough Democratic voters to be able to do it. But in places where you actually, where Democrats could be competitive, these women have just as good a shot as their male counterparts once we, you know, we control for all other factors. And that's what's actually going to sort of boost the representation of women. And so what I would say to Republicans is, you know, sooner or later, people are going to notice how lopsided sort of like the gender representation is even between the two parties. And Republicans are going to have to step up their efforts to recruit women.
I agree with that.
I would say that gender on the ballot probably matters more the deeper you get into the ballot. And so I'd point very specifically to the two PSC races.
And you say that because you're suggesting that those are races that people may not have as much information about?
What I'm saying is there's a ballot drop-off.
Right.
That you have uninterested people who don't know the details of the ticket.
Right.
They're more likely to fall off.
Right.
And so the more active, the more enthusiastic voter is going to hang with that ballot to the very end. And I think those are going to be women this year.
And I will say, though, right, we're acting as if Republicans have no women on the ballot in the PSC race. One of the Republican nominees is a woman.
Right.
And then the 6th Congressional District,
Karen Handel is a
national rising star. So the efforts are underway in the Republican Party to make sure that there's a good balance there on the gender side as well.
Well, but
two of 18.
Well, but wait, to be in all fairness, yeah, but we've seen it play out in terms of the panelists on our own show. I've just mentioned Melita Easters, who is the founder and director of the Georgia Win List, which has for years been trying to recruit Democratic pro-choice women to run, and she's had great success. And on the other hand, Julianne Thompson, a frequent panelist on the show, a conservative Republican, has expressed her frustration that the efforts she's tried to make to recruit more women have not been as successful as she'd like them to be. But Heath, she promises every time she's in here, she's going to do a better job.
But no, there's no question the Republican Party is getting better at that. But it's a couple years behind, and there's a different system within the Democratic Party, right, that allows for the increase in infrastructure Republicans don't have.
I'm out of time. We've got to end the conversation right here. I'm really grateful to Heath Garrett, to Representative Scott Hocum, to Dr. Andra Gillespie, and of course, to my partner, Jim Galloway, for being with us today. Jim Galloway, we haven't even had a chance to talk about the earthquake in the television industry. My old home, Channel 2, apparently on the auction block. Maybe we'll get into that at some point because it has an impact on you too.
Yeah. It's hard to talk about AJC business.
Yeah, don't worry.
Outside.
All right, but I'm out of that business, so I can. Anyhow, that's it for us today. Thank you so much for being with us, everybody. I know we had some audio problems on the Facebook live feed. They're already working to correct them. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you back here again tomorrow for the new 2 o'clock Political Rewind.